Okay, you're listening to CKUT Radio in Montreal, Quebec. I'm Joe Broadhurst, and I'm pleased to be joined on the phone from the Boston area with Professor Howard Zinn, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Boston University. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon.
How are you doing today?
Oh, not bad. I'm glad to be talking to somebody in Montreal. Don't get that chance every day.
Yeah, and talking English to somebody in Montreal, which is...
Yes, you know, I remember once trying to do a broadcast in French to Montreal, and the person at the other end quickly decided we should do it in English.
Well, my accent in French is rather American itself, so I understand where you're coming from on that.
Yeah.
Mr. Zinn, you are an author or co-author of almost 40 books. You've written 3 plays.
Oh, I think that's an exaggeration, but that's okay.
Well, I have a list of
really?
Them, and I counted co-author or author 39 books. I don't know if that's...
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
When you write so many, you maybe lose track of them. Maybe you've
attributed to me some books that I didn't really write. Shakespeare, maybe, or Noam Chomsky. I have written a lot and edited others and co-authored others, so maybe it does add up to more than I think, but I won't argue about that.
And you're currently going around the United States and doing a tour, is that correct?
Well...
Or speaking engagements?
It's not that I'm doing a tour, but a tour suggests that you sort of keep going from one place to another. No, I am doing a lot of traveling. I go here and there, I come back home, I go back again. And last week I was in Indiana, next week I'll be in Wisconsin, following week I'll be in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and then I'll be in San Francisco. So I am doing a lot of traveling, you know. I go around speaking about what's going on in the world today and talking about history and the uses of history and how history might be useful in understanding what's happening.
Can we go back to the beginnings of your life, if we could. And I would like to use that history that you are speaking about with people, because when you draw analysis of the past and the current events, it really puts us in a place where how do you place that, say, World War II against an Iraq war?
World War II. I guess you want to talk about World War II because I was in World War II. I was a bombardier in the Air Force for the United States. And I want to make clear, I wasn't with the Luftwaffe. And I was a bombardier in the Air Force. I volunteered. I enlisted and dropped bombs on various countries in Europe and I must say this, if I'm trying to contrast the war in Iraq with World War II. World War II had a moral core to it, although it's that moral core is very complicated by a lot of immoral acts committed by the Allies, by the United States, the Soviet Union, England. So the morality of World War II is not a simple one. It's a complicated one. But still, there was a core of morality to it. The defeat of fascism, the defeat of an actual threat to Europe and to perhaps much of the rest of the world. In the case of Iraq, we're facing a very different situation. We're not facing a country which is threatening other countries, certainly not threatening the United States, not facing a great military power like Hitler's Germany, not facing a country that invaded other countries. On the contrary, in the case of Iraq, we have invaded Iraq. We are doing to Iraq what Germany did to Czechoslovakia and Hungary. And so it's a situation very, very different. There is not an ounce of morality attached to the war in Iraq, although, of course, the administration tries to put it in moral terms that we're fighting for liberty, fighting for democracy, or that we wanted to, you know, unseat Saddam Hussein. But the truth is that the United States is in Iraq for the most crass of reasons, which have to do with empire, have to do with oil, have to do with political advantage for the Bush administration, and you know, we are occupying Iraq the way Germany was occupying other countries. They had their pretenses. They were doing something. They claimed they were doing something good and useful. We claim we're doing something good and useful, but of course we are not.
Well, the current administration is made up of an element which some people call neoconservatives. And these people actually drew up a plan under the guise of the Project for the New American Century. And they basically told people what they were going to do, and they in that document it does say we need an event like a Pearl Harbor. How do you contrast September 11th and Pearl Harbor?
They both played a certain useful role for the administration in power. That is, Pearl Harbor gave Roosevelt the reason he needed to enter the war in Europe. You might say the attack on Pearl Harbor in itself did not necessarily require entering the war in Europe. You know, the attack on Pearl Harbor could have been answered by defending Pearl Harbor and making sure that another attack like that didn't occur. But no, the Roosevelt administration wanted to present to the American people a situation where the American people would enthusiastically support the idea of war, which they hadn't done up to that point, because Roosevelt had, in fact, when he was elected in 1940, promised that he would keep the United States out of the European war. And almost immediately, of course, he did not. And Pearl Harbor was an excuse enabling him to do that. 9/11 was an excuse for the Bush administration to do what, well, you just suggested, that is to follow through on the agenda, you know, of the, you know, the neocons, the people who, even before 9/11, were talking about unilateral action, about spreading American power all over the world, and of course they were talking about Iraq and planning, really, to go to war against Iraq even before 9/11 happened. So in both cases, Pearl Harbor and 9/11, the administration used something that was very emotionally powerful for the American people. You know, we've been attacked, and used that as a reason to do something it had wanted to do anyway, and that is spread American military power into the Middle East.
I want to go back to World War II again and ask you if you could tell my listeners about Royen, or is it Rouen, in
Royen,
France?
Yeah, the little French town on the Atlantic coast of France, yes. And
that had a very dramatic effect on your life, come to know.
It's true, although at the time I wasn't aware of it. What happened is that we thought we were finished our bombing missions in Europe. I was based in England, a bomber base in England, and it seemed as if we wouldn't have to fly any more bombing missions because, in fact, the war was going to be over in a couple of weeks. It was very clear. Our armies had long since gone across France into Germany. The Russians had come from the other side. They had met on the Elbe River. There was nothing more to do. It was just a few weeks. And then suddenly we were awakened in the morning, very early in the morning, and told we're going on another bombing mission. And we were told we were going to bomb this little town of Royan on the Atlantic coast of France near Bordeaux. Why were we going to do it? Because there were several thousand German soldiers there. Well, actually, the soldiers weren't doing anything. They weren't bothering anybody. They're just waiting for the war to end. But, you know, we were going to bomb them. Not only were we going to bomb them, we were going to use a different type of bomb, they told us in our briefing. Not the usual 500-pound demolition bomb that we were accustomed to dropping, in our bomb bay, we carried 30 100-pound canisters of what they called jellied gasoline. It was napalm. use that term, but it was napalm, first use of napalm in the European theater.
Did they use that act as a way of testing napalm?
It's hard to say. Probably yes. This is the way the military works. They love to try out new weapons. I mean, why did we drop the bomb on Nagasaki even after we had destroyed Hiroshima, and after it seemed clear the war would be over in a few days? We dropped a bomb on Nagasaki. Was it because on Hiroshima we had dropped a uranium bomb, and on Nagasaki we're going to try out a plutonium bomb? And so, you know, it's hard to go into the minds of these people, except that there's a history of the military trying out new weapons and wars being a very good opportunity to do that. So I don't doubt that the trying out of napalm was one of the reasons for that raid. And, you know, what other reasons might there be? Simply the fact that we had all these planes. We sent 1,200 heavy bombers over this little town of a few thousand people. 1,200 heavy bombers. Now, why is that? Because we had them. We had the bombers. We had the equipment. There's another sort of absurd fact about war, and that is a tendency is to use everything you've got. If you've got the weapons, use them. Doesn't matter if you don't need them. Doesn't matter if you're killing people unnecessarily, which is what we did in Royan. We killed thousands of, not only of Germans, but of Frenchmen and women. Yeah, and what else was it? There might be another reason. More medals for anybody who participated in the raid on Royan. And the French at the same time were going to carry on an attack by land on Royan. Absolutely unnecessary. But there too, the French who were carrying out this were eager for more military recognition, more medals. Anyway, it wasn't until after the war that I began to think about that. You know, at the time, I just went ahead. I didn't question it. I was, to this day, I understand how atrocities are carried on by ordinary people like myself, you know, not particularly immoral people, but people who simply have gotten into the habit of doing your job, obeying orders, and deciding at the beginning of the conflict, oh, we're right and they're wrong. And once you make the decision that, oh, we're right and they're wrong, then you don't have to think anymore. Then just you can do anything. You can destroy Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You can kill 600,000 civilians in Germany. You don't think anymore. So I didn't think until after the war. Then I began to think about Royan. I began to think about Royan after I read John Hersey's book on Hiroshima. And for the first time, when he described his talks with the survivors of Hiroshima, you can imagine what these survivors looked like. Horrible scenes, horrible sights. And he recorded what they had to say, their memories of the bomb, the atomic bomb. When I read that for the first time, I understood what bombing did to human beings, because I hadn't understood it up to that point, because I'd been dropping bombs from 30,000 feet, 6 miles high. And from that height, you don't see any people, you don't see any human beings, you don't hear any screams, you don't see any blood, I don't see children being dismembered. And so for the first time, reading about Hiroshima, I realized what bombing does to human beings. From that point on, I was opposed to war, because war, any war, because whatever the reason given, because war in our time is the indiscriminate killing of large numbers of innocent people.
And we're now seeing the U.S. start to rev up and want to attack Iran, and with the result of innocent people being killed again. Do you think that the Bush administration can sell that war to the American people after what's happened in Iraq?
I hope not. And frankly, I don't think it can. But the Bush administration seems able to carry on a policy even if the American people oppose it. Right now, 70 to 80% of the American people oppose the war in Iraq, but Bush is carrying on that war. So he could, even though I don't think the American people would support a war on Iran. I think Bush might do it anyway, in his kind of desperate attempt to boost his standing at a time when his standing is very, very low among the American people. And he may have what I think is a mistaken idea that if he starts another war, it will have the same effect as the war in Iraq, and that is people will rush to the colors and rush to declare their support for the president. I think he will be mistaken if he thinks that, because I do think the American people have learned something from the war in Iraq. After all, this scare about Iran's nuclear weapons is very similar to the scare about Iraq's nuclear weapons. There, too, Iraq was not anywhere near building a nuclear weapon, but still the president and the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, they all raised the specter of nuclear weapons in such a way as to scare the American people. And now they're trying to do the same thing with Iran, even though it's very clear from anybody who knows anything about nuclear weapons and what you need to do, that Iran is years and years and years away from developing a nuclear weapon.
And I believe even there were some commission reports that were done in the late 90s that said that Iran would, even if it started back then, it would take 10 years for them to come up with anything. So
yeah, and here we are in 2006, and I just saw a report. In fact, I think the National Intelligence Estimate, which is the official intelligence agency of the United States, has said it would take years and years for the Iranians to develop a nuclear weapon. But you know, the Bush administration is so arrogant, so confident of holding onto its power and doing what it wants to do, that it ignores even the reports of its own official agency.
I want to go back because you stated something very important, I think, before, which was at 30,000 feet, you don't see the bombs hitting the people, and you don't see the people being affected by those bombs.
Yes.
And I question whether the American people have an idea of what has happened in Iraq. Do you sense that Americans are waking up to the fact that people are being lives are being destroyed and what the bombs actually do?
I wish I could say that the American people have an idea, a fairly clear idea of what's happening to the people in Iraq. I don't think they do. I think they have a vague idea about it. I think probably more people in the United States today think about Iraqi casualties than they did, you know, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. But it's still true that the human toll of the war in Iraq is largely lost to the American people. And that's because the American media have done a terrible job of reporting the war, have not really brought home to the American people what we are doing. You'd have to go to the internet. You'd have to go to alternative sources. You'd have to talk to people who actually, let's say, been in Fallujah when the United States attacked Fallujah, and get a sense of the horror we inflict on those people. I don't think the American people have a real sense of that. Occasionally, they will get a glimpse of it. I remember, you know, a few days after Bush's inauguration speech, this last inauguration speech where he talked about the United States having a kind of mission to spread liberty around the world. A few days after that, in the New York Times, there was a picture of a little Iraqi girl crying, bleeding. Her parents had just been killed by American soldiers who had fired and destroyed their car. So occasionally a little glimpse of that comes through. So, and maybe those little glimpses and of course the thought of Americans being killed. Maybe that has made more Americans sensitive to what's happening to Iraq. But as I said, I don't think the full impact of human suffering among the Iraqis has been brought home to the American people, and I blame the media for that.
Who, in fact, do you blame? Do you blame the New York Times and the Washington Post and the large papers like that, or?
I do. I blame the major media. I blame the major television stations, and they will report about that the American deaths have risen to 2,300. They will not even report. They will not even give the American people a full picture of those Americans who come back from Iraq, those soldiers who come back from Iraq alive, but really crippled. That is, amputees. People have lost arms and legs. People have been blinded. I don't think the American people have a really, really clear picture of that. And there, too, I blame the media for not bringing, the major media, for not bringing that story home to the American people. I mean, they show on television every night, they tell you what the Dow Jones average is. Every night they should show the picture of an American who has come back from Iraq crippled. The media is simply not doing their job.
I spoke with a reporter a few weeks back, and he said that they had been proposing stories, but the editors had said that the Americans don't want to hear that. Do you think the Americans want to hear the truth?
Well, it's painful to hear the truth, but I think Americans would appreciate hearing the truth. I think that's a very easy excuse to say we're not telling them the truth because they don't want the truth. No, I think that's a very lame excuse given by an editor who is beholden to the bosses of the corporation and who are so in cahoots with the government, they don't want to alarm the American people. They don't want to provoke the American people. And you probably know that, there were sort of instructions given in television, like from the officials of CNN, instructions given to their reporters saying, don't play up the civilian casualties in Iraq. Now, that's really morally reprehensible. Don't play up the civilian casualties in Iraq. The American people, I think, would appreciate getting the truth.
The New York Times worked with the Bush administration in holding back a story on the NSA spy wiretapping story. What are your interpretations of that as you lived through the 70s and perhaps saw another administration who was maybe doing the same thing or close to it, where they were monitoring groups, and we found out that the actual Pentagon is monitoring peaceful groups and somewhat labeling them as terrorists. So how do you see that in relation to what happened during the 70s, what's happening now?
Yes, well, there was a program, there's an FBI program called the COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program, which was a secret program, which we only learned about when some unknown radicals broke into FBI offices in a little town in Pennsylvania in the early 1970s. And they found all these records of this program, COINTELPRO. And then, only later, in 1975, did a Senate committee investigating intelligence agencies, investigating the FBI, give a report on this program. This program involved illegal actions by the FBI, breaking into people's homes, spying on people without a warrant, sending anonymous letters to people threatening them, sending anonymous letters to employers so that people would be fired. The other part of the story is you're talking about going back. I'm thinking of going back to the 60s, to the early 60s, when the New York Times withheld stories that the Kennedy administration did not want them to report, like the coming invasion of Cuba in the Bay of Pigs. There was information on that. There was information about preparations for that. And the New York Times was doing its, quote, patriotic duty by withholding information. And, of course, by doing that, they were withholding information from what turned out to be a disaster for the American government. That is a failure failed attempt to invade Cuba. But the collaboration between the major media and the government, the Washington Post, the New York Times, has been going on for a long time.
Does that affect whether you read them or not? Do you read the New York Times? Or...
Well, I do read the New York Times, knowing that the New York Times is going to every day violate the slogan on its masthead, that all the news that's fit to print. Knowing that the New York Times is not going to give me all the news that's fit to print, that I'll have to go elsewhere for all the news. Knowing that the New York Times will only give me the news that they see fit to print, but still I'll read the New York Times because they will report what the president is saying. They will report what the Secretary of Defense is saying. And also because despite the collaboration between the sort of the higher echelons of the New York Times and the government, there are individual reporters who will report stories that will get past the editors, or that the editors will allow to get past them, which are revealing, and which in fact amount to good investigative reporting. So if you read the New York Times carefully, especially read the inside pages and read down to the bottom of the stories, you will very often get important information, because individual reporters who don't have the same mindset as their bosses will give you data that they think the public should have.
You've been in the anti-war movement for a long time now, and you've seen changes over that period of time. Where do you think the anti-war movement stands in the United States right now? Does it remain a powerful force in the communities, or do you see a disintegration of that under the guise of patriotism and other things?
Well, it's true that charges of being unpatriotic are always... always have a certain effect on diminishing what might be a larger and stronger movement. But we do have an anti-war movement in the United States, and I believe it is growing. And we don't see visible signs of that for a couple of reasons. One, because the media, getting back to the media do not report all of the anti-war actions that are taking place around the country. People in New York will not know that there are 6 anti-war groups in Montana that are carrying on weekly vigils. It's only when something really sensational takes place, like Cindy Sheehan going to Texas, to Crawford, only then, will the media really cover it. But the media have done a terrible job of covering the anti-war movement. They ignore anti-war actions that take place around the country. The other point is that the anti-war movement is decentralized. It is local. We don't see the huge gatherings of anti-war people that we saw during the Vietnam War. But we have anti-war activities taking place in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cities around the United States. I mean, at the time Cindy Sheehan went to Crawford, Texas, there were events that took place in 600 American cities around the country. So, I mean, everywhere I go in the United States, and I travel a lot, everywhere I go, however small the town, there's some anti-war group there. So while I don't want to exaggerate the strength of the anti-war movement, we have not reached the point, not hardly, point where the anti-war movement had gone during the Vietnam War. You might say we're perhaps at the point where the movement against the Vietnam War was in the first couple of years of the war. It took a while for the anti-war movement to really build to a crescendo during the Vietnam War. Not until 68, 69, 70, after the war had been going on for 4, 5, 6 years. So I expect the anti-war movement to grow, just as the public opinion has grown about the war.
I believe I remember reading that in 1965 you had gathered with some people in the Boston Commons, and about 100 people showed up, and then I think a couple of years later in 68 or 69, 100,000 people showed up. So
that's right, yeah. That's exactly true, yeah. And that very first anti-war meeting on the Boston Common, about 100 people were there. And in October of 69, when there was this great mobilization of people around the country, we had 100,000 people on the Boston Common. And so, as I say, no, we certainly can't claim that the anti-war movement has reached the height that it did during the Vietnam War, but it is growing. And I think what is maybe the most important factor is that dissension among the GIs in Iraq is growing. The number of soldiers coming back from Iraq and turning against the war is growing. After all, during the Vietnam War, I think that was a very crucial factor in finally bringing the war to an end. That is the fact that GIs came back from Vietnam, formed Vietnam Veterans Against the War, made themselves visible to the entire nation. That was very crucial. I think the growing disaffection from the Iraq War among GIs, men and women, I think if that continues, I think that may be a critical factor for the anti-war movement.
In the 70s, we saw that there seemed to be small groups like the Weather Underground, who had sort of gone away from the peace movement and had begun committing bombings and things like that to make their get their point across. Do you think we're going to see movements like that in the United States again?
Well, I don't know. In every situation where something terrible is going on, some injustice is going on, while most people who struggle against that injustice are nonviolent, there will always be a small number of people who become really agitated, desperate, and in their desperation they will turn to violence. And you know, the weather people were just anguished about the fact that the war in Vietnam was going on and on and on, and they felt frustrated. And that's what happens when people in the movement get frustrated that policy remains the same, then some people will turn to violence. So it's conceivable that that could happen. It hasn't happened yet. I hope it doesn't happen, because I think that more effective than these small, desperate acts of violence is the organization of hundreds of thousands of millions of people.
You had stated in the past that you had hoped that the U.S. would move from being a military superpower to a humanitarian superpower. But I wonder, with all of the leaks coming out of Iraq with torture, and we have Guantanamo Bay, has the U.S. Army, in its quest for a long war, or the long war, is it sort of taken that humanitarian aspect of America out of the way so that there can be a long war, do you think? Is that possible?
Well, of course they're trying their best. I mean, talk about humanitarianism. We've gone the opposite way. I mean, we have engaged in torture and terrible cruelties, and it will take an awful lot. It will a very drastic turnaround. It will take a great social movement in this country to turn the government away from these horrific policies, detaining thousands of people without trial, torturing people. It'll take a huge movement in the United States to turn the government away from that and to do something which is very much needed, but which is a very sort of radical step away from the way the government is behaving now, and that is for the government to simply stop being a war-making power, to withdraw from its military bases all over the world, and to use the hundreds of billions of dollars now spent for war for humanitarian purposes here and abroad. It's obviously we're a long way from that. Obviously, we've in fact have been moving in the opposite direction. But my hope is that at some point, and I don't know when that will be, the Bush administration will face so much opposition in this country, among the GIs, from other countries abroad. And, you know, there's more and more opposition in Latin America to the United States. More and more reluctance to go along with American power in various parts of the world. And my hope is that that will reach the point where the government will still will just not be able to continue the present policies. I don't know when that will happen, but that's what I'm hoping for.
Do you think that there needs to be accountability for these actions?
By accountability, mean put people put on trial?
Well, do you think that the world will just accept that if the U.S. stopped pushing militarism and moved more to humanitarianism, they've had a pretty big effect on the rest of the world as far as humanitarian rights and these preemptive wars.
Yes.
Do you think that it's going to take some kind of accountability for the world to get back into terms with the United States? Or do you think the United States needs to be back on terms with the rest of the world?
Well, you know, I think it would be good for the United States to become connected with that rest of the world, which is now so angry at American policies. And I think that the leaders of the U.S. government who have followed these policies should be held accountable. I'm not talking about Nuremberg trials. I'm not talking about hangings. I'm not talking about death penalties. But I'm talking about more likely the commissions of reconciliation that took place in South Africa, where at least, if not putting the people, the war makers and the torturers in prison, holding them up before the world as objects of shame, maybe following the policies that the Native American tribes used before Columbus arrived, before the Americans arrived, the policies of when somebody did something antisocial, you didn't punish them physically, but you shamed them. You held them up before the community. I think that should be done to the people who are now promulgating these immoral policies.
We're going to have to go soon, but I did want to ask you a couple of questions from the News Collective. We are a news collective. We are a community-run radio station here in Montreal. And I was wondering if you could give our listeners an idea of the role that community radio stations and alternative newspapers play in the anti-war movement, but in general in the community over your lifetime.
I have depended enormously on alternative sources of information. I mean, if I only had to read Time and Newsweek and watch CBS and ABC and read the Times and Washington Post, I might well fall a prey to government propaganda so many Americans have. Alternative media have been tremendously important. During the Vietnam War, for instance, the My Lai massacre was exposed to the public by alternative media, not by the Times, not by any of the major media, even though the information was known. It had been printed in a newspaper in Europe, but they would not touch the story until Dispatch News Service, this alternative little news service where Seymour Hersh was working, exposed the My Lai massacre. We depended during the Vietnam War on alternative newspapers all over the country. We depended on community radio stations. I mean, Pacifica was born at that time. And today, more than ever, we depend on the community radio stations. We depend on Pacifica. We depend on David Barsamian's alternative radio coming out of Boulder, Colorado. We depend on cable stations because we depend on the Internet because information is crucial. If the public does not have information, you do not have democracy. If information is controlled, then you have a totalitarian situation. So, you know, I believe that that democracy requires a widespread knowledge of what is going on. And for that, we need alternative radio stations and alternative newspapers and every possible way we can of getting independent sources for the public.
I have another question from a collective member, and his name is Dave Tassium, and he had asked me to ask you, what do you think the most important event is that has taken place in the last century, as a historian? tough question. But.
tough question. Probably I think the most important event that has taken place is the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima as a kind of warning to the world and warning to people in the United States about the enormous dangers of entrusting governments with the lives of the human race. From that point of view, you know, that was maybe the most critical event in this century.
Okay. Well, I've been joined, thankfully, by Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Boston University. His name is Professor Howard Zinn, and I thank you for joining me this afternoon. I hope we have a chance to speak in the future.
And, I hope so.
And I thank you for going around and letting everybody know your perspective on things, because I think that these kinds of things are when you're out talking to the people and telling them the truth. Then I think perhaps that you're actually making a very real change in society, and hopefully people are learning. So
we're all of us doing our best. Your radio station too. So keep up the good work.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and have a good afternoon. Bye bye.
Thank you.